Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Today marks the anniversary of Charles Lindbergh's birth. He's closely associated with St. Louis, of course. We'll talk about that association and more in just a couple of moments. But first, February is National Heart Month. Matters of the heart get a lot of attention as Valentine's Day approaches, but on this program, we typically devote some of our time in February to heart disease, the world's number one killer. Joining us today to talk about heart disease, research, and treatment, as he has often done in the past, is Washington University School of Medicine cardiologist Dr. Andrew Cates. He's with Barnes Jewish Hospital. Dr. Cates, nice to see you again.
Thank you for having me.
As we said earlier, if it's February, Dr. Cates must be in the room.
Well, thanks. It's a pleasure to be here, and I appreciate doing this again this year.
You know, I'd like to start with something that kind of mystifies me, and that is, if heart disease is the world's number one killer, what is really going on? I mean, there are different diets, there are different lifestyles, different behaviors, different environments. Why is it so omnipresent?
Well, you know, it's difficult to say. There are a lot of different factors that account for cardiovascular disease. And as you mentioned, I mean, being the number one killer, certainly in the U.S. and around the world in developed nations, you know, there are risk factors that we look at that predispose patients to cardiovascular disease. And actually, as we start up, I do want to talk about some of the statistics. You mentioned just how common it is. And I think understanding just what that means really should help raise the awareness. So if we think about it, coronary heart disease caused about one out of every six deaths in the U.S. last year. And back in 2010, about 400,000 Americans died from coronary heart disease. And each year, about 600,000 Americans have a heart attack. So that's really impressive numbers. And if we think about that, what that translates to is about 2,000 Americans every day dying from cardiovascular disease. Now, when we talk about, you mentioned cardiovascular disease, we think about the umbrella cardiovascular disease. That includes heart attacks, strokes, peripheral vascular disease, coronary artery disease. And coronary heart disease itself is what we'll be focusing on a little bit more today. But that is, again, very, very common. And importantly, though, as we talk about prevention, we should realize we've actually made steps over the last several years, and we're reducing the death rate from cardiovascular disease. From 2000 to 2010, that rate decreased by about 31%. So we're doing a better job, yet despite that, the numbers, the most recent data really is from about 2010. The numbers say that we still have a long way to go. And again, I think that's why we're here.
So what is going on? Is it an organ that just wears out over time and must wear out, or is it behavior?
The challenge is, that's a great question, the challenge that we face is it's complex. There are multiple factors that come into play. And when we think about it, we think in the terms of primary prevention, we look towards risk factors that predispose patients to cardiovascular disease, like hypertension, high cholesterol, diabetes, smoking. We also look at other conditions like physical lack of activity, and those play some part in it. There are other potentially preventable risk factors. But then we also look, we know those are primary disease states we like to prevent. Then we look towards primordial prevention is a term we can use, which looks to preventing the development of those risk factors. Now, just what's going on a basic level, that's an area that's fertile for research, is we look for other reasons why these conditions predispose patients to developing cardiovascular disease.
I would have to think, we all know that obesity is one of the problems, and there's been a lot of discussion about childhood obesity lately. Does this mean that what we're looking forward to potentially and probably is a sharp increase in the number of heart attacks by people who are very young today?
Well, and as we look, and again, you mentioned a very important risk factor for development of cardiovascular disease and other complicating conditions, obesity. And we look at what contributes to obesity, including inactivity and diet and other lifestyle issues. So as we think about that, you're right, the younger population, childhood obesity becomes a very important issue. And we know that children who are obese are more likely to become obese adults. We know that children of obese adults are more likely to become obese. And that's one of the challenges that we face again. And you mentioned this, are we training a generation that's going to be more likely to develop cardiovascular disease? And I think the answer is probably yes, but we also realize that there are important steps to take now. And this idea of primordial prevention, where if we can affect children at an early age with appropriate diet, appropriate levels of activity, and even, you know, potentially starting them on pharmacologic therapy at an earlier age, maybe we can help prevent the development of those risk factors for cardiovascular disease, but then also prevent the development of cardiovascular disease itself.
Which means that we have to do a better job of educating the parents, because they're the ones who will be in charge here.
That's right, and that's where, again, that's a key player here.
as I mentioned at the outset, we talked for several years now at this time of year because it's National Heart Month, and it's a good thing to talk about because heart disease is the killer that it is. But has anything happened since the last time we've talked to cause any dramatic change in thinking or therapy or what have you?
Well, I think a few things have come forth, and one thing we've seen is reassessment based on guidelines. So the American Heart Association, the American College of Cardiology have put out a set of guidelines for prevention just last year that focused on specific areas, cholesterol, lifestyle changes, obesity and hypertension. And what was done was really reassessing the studies that have that formed the basis for recommendations. So specifically, say with cholesterol, the updated cholesterol guidelines suggested that the way we approached treating cholesterol before, and many listeners may be aware that patients have been told for a long time to know your numbers, to we treat patients to a certain cholesterol level depending upon what their risk is. Well, the updated guidelines, which just came out last year, really reassessed those studies that were done and said, you know what, as we look at this, the idea of treating somebody to a specific number isn't necessarily as important as just treating them for their risk. So what that meant is we kind of redefined how we treat patients with elevated cholesterol. So rather than just, again, saying we need to treat you to a number, we identified specific patients who we knew were at risk. So those patients who had atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, so if they've had a heart attack or stroke in the past, if you were diabetic, if you had very elevated LDL levels, or if you were at high risk based upon multiple risk factors, then you were a patient who could potentially benefit from being on a cholesterol medicine, specifically a statin. So we're kind of reassessing some of the data that had been available, but taking a more scientific approach to it. So that's helped, and I think that's really changed our approach. And we're trying to target patients who are at higher risk at an earlier age, at an earlier stage, to help prevent cardiovascular disease from developing.
But unless they come to you, how are you going to find them?
Well, so that's true. And that's where, well, talking with your, well, educating our physician community as well, but educating the public. So knowing the importance of screening, appropriate screening, so having your cholesterol checked at appropriate interval, seeing your primary care physician to be screened for blood pressure elevation, being screened for diabetes, and seeing your primary care doc and knowing that if you're at risk, so knowing if you're at risk based upon an important family history, if you're not particularly physically active, if you're overweight, so knowing if you have some of those risk factors as well.
Is there an age quotient here? Should people in their 20s start going to the doctor and having this checked out?
Well, it's important, and I think what's recommended is at least an initial screening by age 20, so to have your cholesterol checked at age 20. We do know that cholesterol problems can run in families. Now, it's not the mild elevation of cholesterol that we see that may put you at slightly increased risk. It's the marked elevation. So an LDL or bad cholesterol of more than 190, that's typically associated with some type of mutation in the cholesterol receptors. So knowing that and having that screened at age 20, because we know if we identify you, then this is a specific subgroup that's at very high risk and probably should be on a statin at a very early age. So being screened at 20 for that, for blood pressure potentially, for being overweight, for risk for diabetes, knowing at that age if you're at risk, so we can take those appropriate steps. And again, in treating that and realizing the importance of early intervention, not just with pharmacologic therapy, but with lifestyle changes as well.
I want to open up our lines to our listening audience because our time is somewhat limited today. And if you have questions for Dr. Andrew Cates, we'd love to take your calls at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email to talk@stlpublicradio.org. We'll take a tweet at STL on air. What about the notion of self-monitoring?
So self-monitoring for
cardiovascular
anything.
Issue.
So I think it is I encourage patients to ask questions. I think self-monitoring to look for if you're – the idea of knowledge if you're at risk or not I think is important. I think monitoring one's own cholesterol is challenging. We see patients who will go to say health fairs, community health fairs, and see that for $100 they can have a screening test done. And maybe this is what you're alluding to. They can have a multiple set of images done of their carotid arteries, of their heart, of their abdomen, their abdominal aorta, get a cholesterol profile done. And the challenge is they get that done and the comment says fine or not fine, and then that's it. And they don't necessarily follow up on that because they're told that they're fine. And that type of self-monitoring doesn't really help. I think getting those results and speaking with a physician who's who knows what he or she is talking about, I think is much more important. And I strongly discourage my patients from doing those health fair screening tests, because it's good to identify maybe the initially, but doing that in isolation of seeing a physician or another healthcare provider, PA or nurse practitioner, that's not a good idea.
What about investing $50 at Walgreens and buying one of those blood pressure machines that will monitor your blood pressure and your heart?
So that's your pulse? And thank you. Thanks for bringing that up. I think that direction, I think, is important. And we do encourage our patients who have hypertension to check their blood pressures at home. And that's in many ways a better reflection of blood pressure than when they come into to the office and have their blood pressure checked there. So I do think monitoring one's blood pressure and knowing how to do it appropriately is important as well. So that's certainly important. I think the idea of not to use the training, but the Fitbit, I'm not endorsing any specific product here, but with the Fitbit per se, say that is, it's not a bad idea if it gets people to be more active, and that type of contest, if you will, really promotes activity for them. I think that's a very good idea.
You know, I don't mean this to sound facetious, but it's gotten some buzz around here recently, and that is, I mentioned people could contact us by Twitter, and mm-hmm. there was a story in one of the publications basically saying you can use Twitter as a predictor of heart issues.
I saw that, and that's this is one of those cocktail party type of studies that come out that you need to be versed in, so when people ask about it, you can have a little comment on it. And what that looked at, from my understanding, is seeing what people tweeted and if they had angry tweets or if they had some type of social tweet, that they may or may not be more predisposed to developing cardiovascular disease or having a heart attack or stroke. And I think it's something that's interesting, and I guess it teaches you have to be careful what you say, right?
and don't rely on it.
That's right.
Can safely say don't rely on that.
That's right.
Our guest is Dr. Andrew Cates from the Washington University School of Medicine and Barnes Jewish Hospital. We're talking about heart disease, cardiovascular problems. We'll have to take a break now. We'll do that and come back. We have a number of calls, and we'll get right to them as soon as we come back after this break. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back. We'll be continuing our conversation with Dr. Andrew Cates of Barnes Jewish Hospital, Washington University School of Medicine, in just a moment. But first, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. The Missouri Senate is considering a bill that would address many of the issues that came up during the unrest in Ferguson following Michael Brown's death. The bill is sponsored by Maria Chappelle Nadal, and among other things, it would require police officers to wear body cameras and require all policing agencies to be accredited by the Commission on Accreditation for Law Enforcement Agencies. It also calls for a special prosecutor to be appointed in police shootings when the suspect is unarmed. The United Way is looking to connect with people who lost their jobs when the businesses they worked in for Ferguson, in Ferguson and Delwood, were destroyed during the November and earlier unrest. The organization says these displaced employees may be eligible for basic needs assistance, but so far the group is having trouble finding some of these people. And Lambert Airport has developed a 5-year strategic plan to address the changing transportation needs in the region. Civic and business leaders helped create the plan, which maps out objectives for growth, air service, and economic development. You can learn more about these and other stories this afternoon on St. Louis Public Radio and throughout the day at stlpublicradio.org. Lots to talk about, but let's take a couple of phone calls, Doctor. We'll start with Dan, who is calling from Kirkwood. Dan, go ahead.
I have a question about the risk benefits of taking a statin. My only risk that I know of is that I'm 68 years old. I watch my diet. I exercise regularly. I maintain a good weight. If I don't take a statin, my cholesterol is like 220, but my HDL is like 80 or 90. If I take a statin, like a half of a Lipitor, 5 milligrams of Lipitor, my cholesterol drops to like 178 with a 60 HDL. Considering the risks of statins and benefits, whatever, am I better off with a little higher cholesterol not taking a statin, or should I go ahead and continue to take a minimal amount of statin?
Dan, that's a great question. Thank you for bringing this up. So the challenge, and as you brought this up, you're wondering if you need to take this to lower your numbers. And remember, the reason why we treat patients isn't to lower their numbers. It's to lower their risk of having a heart attack or stroke. So, Dan, you're somebody, and without knowing all of your history, presuming if you don't have coronary artery disease now, if you don't have diabetes, and you said your LDL isn't that high, say over 190, you're somebody in whom the most appropriate evaluation is to do a more formal type of risk stratification. So there's something called the pooled cohort equation, which takes into account several different studies, and taking data from that, those studies has created an equation which lets us plug in how old you are, your sex, if you have high blood pressure or not, if you smoke, if you have diabetes. And taking that into account, we can calculate your risk of having a heart attack or stroke over the next 10 years. And we know that in patients whose risk is more than 7.5%, those are patients who may benefit from being on a statin. So without being able to do those numbers in my head and not knowing your blood pressure, I would suggest, encourage you to do this, talk with your physician or the healthcare provider about this as well, and determine just what your risk is. And then the recommendations are not necessarily that you be on a statin, but that at least it's discussed with you and talking about the risks and benefits. Now, let me briefly speak about the risks and benefits, because there's a lot of misinformation that's out there that people presume that statins are bad because they've talked with their friends and somebody had liver problems or muscle problems. When we look at the data and look at the data appropriately, we realize that the main concern patients have is a muscle injury or muscle toxicity. The risk is about 1 in 10 to have muscle pains. The risk of having significant muscle injury is well less than 1%. And honestly, unless you have other medications you take or have other liver issues, then, I'm sorry, other specific medications or other reasons, you should be, the risk of having rhabdomyolysis, which is significant muscle problems, is very low. The risk of liver injury is incredibly low as well, so low now that it's no longer recommended that we do routine screening for LFT abnormalities, liver function test abnormalities. One-time test is fine, and that's it. So again, for you, I think you need to talk with your primary care physician to determine truly if you need to be on a statin or not. Then if, based upon your risk, you do need to be on one, then what's recommended is a moderate intensity statin, say 10 milligrams or 20 of atorvastatin. So thank you for the question.
Thanks for the call, Dan. You mentioned the liver. It makes me think of alcohol vis-a-vis cardiovascular issues.
Yeah, and so what's interesting with alcohol, and there's a study that came out recently looking at moderate alcohol consumption and the potential benefit. We've known for a while that alcohol may have some cardioprotective effects. But first, we should say that in general, alcohol causes more problems than it solves. And the risk of significant liver injury or significant heart-related problems with high alcohol consumption is very important. But there was a study that came out just last week, the study from the ARIC study, which is a large longitudinal study looking at patients at risk for cardiovascular disease. They looked at about 14,000 patients, and it was a 24-year follow-up. And they looked at what the risk of having a heart failure was related to how much you drank. What was discovered was that for men and women, drinking between 1 and 7 drinks per week actually resulted in some degree of cardiovascular benefit, lower risk of developing heart failure. For those that didn't drink at all or for those that drank more than 14 drinks per week, for men more than 14, for women more than 7 drinks per week, there was actually a higher risk. So their sweet spot is, say, 1 to 7 drinks. Remembering, though, that what one drink is, it's not what you want it to be. It's a beer, a 12-ounce beer. It's 4 ounces of wine, 1.5 ounces of hard alcohol. What I tell patients also, because this happens all the time, they calculate in their heads, well, if I can have 7 drinks per week, can I have 7 drinks on Saturday? No. It's actually spread over the course of the week. So just interesting. So moderation is key. As somebody important once said, everything in moderation, including moderation.
Right? All right. Let's take another call. Melanie in O'Fallon, Missouri. It's your turn. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm one of those annoying self-styled nutrition nerds who reads a lot of health books. And all the books that we've read, we've concluded that one of the simplest, easiest things people can do to boost their health is take supplemental magnesium, because so many Americans are deficient. It's crucial for hundreds of processes in the body. It regulates electrical signals, including heartbeat. And yet, doctors routinely urge older people, especially women, to take its natural agonist, calcium, for bones. But calcium alone doesn't promote strong bones, and it actually can throw the balance of magnesium further out of whack. People who have muscle cramps, restless legs, eyelid twitches, migraines, these are all symptoms of probable magnesium deficiency. It's often given, I believe, in IV form in ERs to people coming in with heart issues. So I'm wondering, why is it not encouraged
Melanie, you ask a great question, and this is the challenge, and I like the term nutritional nerds, and honestly, I want to give a shout-out to my dietitian colleagues. The importance of speaking with a registered dietitian when it comes to really talking about dietary issues cannot be underestimated. I mean, they really know what they're talking about and have spent, had the appropriate training. But when it comes to supplements and the issue of supplemental magnesium, we can talk at length about. But I think the bigger picture here is when we talk about supplements, the data with supplements in general is pretty poor. When we look at good studies that are done, and we need to do these studies, say, with fish oil, with folate, with antioxidants, when studies are done that truly are randomized trials looking at the effects of supplements, we found again and again that supplements just aren't beneficial. And you can say that, well, there's a study that shows that, you know, giving magnesium may counteract the effects of calcium and may help with twitches. But honestly, I would challenge you to show me that data, show me that it was in a peer-reviewed journal, and show me that it really is a well-done study to show that supplements are helpful. We seem to find, again, we saw this with giving supplements for women with hormonal therapy for women. We found, we used to think it was beneficial, could reduce the risk of cardiovascular disease to give estrogen replacement therapy postmenopausal for women with cardiovascular disease. And when the study was done that actually looked at doing it, blinded, double-blind randomized controlled trial, we found that, you know what, it wasn't helpful. In fact, it could be harmful. So again, supplements, if we want to take supplements, we need to see good data before we go recommending it.
We've had a couple of questions, people asking what statins are. We've mentioned those a couple of times.
Thank you. So I apologize. Thanks for bringing that up. When we talk about terms of medications available for treating cholesterol, there are multiple agents that are available. There are drugs like statins. There are drugs like niacin or bile acid sequestrants or fibrates. There are different drugs that are available that help modify or reduce cholesterol levels, specifically the bad cholesterol. And statins are the best-studied drugs in that category and of all have shown the most benefit to reducing cholesterol.
Should we all be taking an aspirin or two a day?
Not all of us. So I think this is also a very challenging topic and has undergone multiple different reevaluations over the course of time. If we think about different patient populations, this is where, again, not one thing applies to everybody. We do know that patients who have cardiovascular disease benefit from aspirin for secondary prevention, so prevent it from recurring. When it comes to primary prevention, that's where the jury is still out. We think there are specific populations that benefit. We think that women over 65 may benefit from being on an aspirin to help reduce the risk of stroke. We think that men over 55 may benefit as well. And I say we think because there's conflicting data. So we always have to weigh the risks and benefit. And for a young person being on aspirin, it may not be beneficial, and there's always the risk of harm with increased risk of bleeding complications. So yeah. I think it doesn't apply to everybody, but for certain people, it is appropriate.
It can be a problem for your stomach, as I understand, aspirin.
Correct.
Let's take another call. Jay joins us from Normandy. Jay, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, I've always thought that a low BP, low blood pressure, and low heartbeat is a good thing. Resting heartbeat low, like a Lance Armstrong or a Roger Federer, is a great thing. But now I've been told that there might be a relationship where it might be too slow. And I'd like to know the interrelationship of that and maybe someday having to worry about a pacemaker. Thank you.
So this is a little bit of a challenging topic because, again, without having more information, one can't say that a low heart rate is bad for you in particular. We do know that the heart rate is just part of the equation when it comes to what your body needs to maintain a healthy life, if you will. We know that heart rate is just part of the equation. How much your heart squeezes, how much your heart pumps out is important as well, too. So a low heart rate can certainly be adaptive for many people if they're active. You know, the good athlete can have a low heart rate, the trained athlete per se, where for some, and that's normal. For some older patients, though, who have conduction problems, so their heart's electrical activity doesn't work like it should, a low heart rate may be detrimental. And for those patients who have symptoms clearly attributable to a low heart rate, well, then a pacemaker may be appropriate. But that's, again, that's a very complicated question that, unfortunately, we only have a half hour today. Otherwise, we could talk more about that. And low blood pressure, that's also, again, a somewhat complicated discussion to have. We know that for older patients, low blood pressure may not be better. The guidelines have been reevaluated again. We know that for our patients, say, over 80, and some people would say over 60, that a systolic upper number of less than 150 is all we really need to target for.
But what is a preferable heart rate?
So ideally, a heart rate of 60 to 80 is what we would call normal. But again, everybody is different, and you may need a slightly higher heart rate for different reasons or not. So,
okay. You had indicated off the air that there might be some new information with regard to the value of jogging.
So this comes up, and we, you know, first, you know, physical activity is important, and we've come to learn over years that at least some physical activity is better than nothing. You know, back 25 or 30 years ago, it was actually felt that unless you exercise vigorously, there was little cardiovascular benefit, and then it kind of got pushed back to where we thought moderate intensity activity may be helpful, and then newer data has emerged to where even some physical activity may be better than doing nothing. You know, the issue with jogging has come up repeatedly as to how much jogging is good versus bad. And some of the listeners may be aware that there's some data that says jogging too much can be detrimental. I'm a little bit biased. I enjoy running, so I think it's good for you. But there's the data that suggested, there's a study that came out back to just this week in Journal of American College of Cardiology from a study called the Copenhagen City Heart Study that looked at about 5,000 individuals. 1,000 were healthy joggers. There were 4,000 healthy non-joggers, and they follow them over the course of time, and they kind of divide them into different categories. For those that jogged, well, what they ended up finding was that those that jogged between 1 to 2.5 hours per week, 2 to 3 times, I'm sorry, 1 to 2.5 hours weekly, maybe 2 to 3 times per week, they had the lowest mortality. So if you didn't jog at all, your mortality was a little bit higher than if you jog between 1 to 2.5 hours per week. But then the more you jog there, that benefit was lost. So there seems to be some benefit to some jogging, at least. Too much may not be helpful. The jury is still out on that.
And if you can't jog, walking's okay, too.
Walking's okay, too.
Okay. I know you wanted to mention your patient navigator program. That's something new, I guess.
Thank you. And this is a program that we just launched yesterday, actually. It's in partnership with the American College of Cardiology, Barnes-Jewish Hospital, and Washington University. And it's called the Patient Navigator Program. And the background behind this relates to patients who are admitted to the hospital, we know, are at higher risk for being readmitted. We know that nearly 1 in 5 patients who are hospitalized with a heart attack and 1 out of 4 hospitalized with heart failure are readmitted within 30 days of being discharged. And that costs a lot of money. So about $17.4 billion back in 2004 were spent on these readmissions. And the thing is, a lot of times these readmissions are for conditions that are either unrelated to the original diagnosis or for avoidable reasons. They may need to just be seen quicker, they may need to be more compliant, or may need to be more active. So the American College of Cardiology, again, has established this program, and WashU and Barnes are one of 35 hospitals around the country to be selected for this, and it's called the Patient Navigator Program. And what this is patients are assigned a part of a navigator system where they're followed by physicians and nurse practitioners and other nursing support as they leave the hospital to ensure that they get good follow-up. We have a clinic that's been established to make sure that patients are seen early. And it's a quality improvement initiative, too, so we can track how we do. So as patients come into the hospital, we can track them. We can see how, as we implement this type of program to ensure good follow-up, make sure that we do better. And again, we're excited to be part of this. Like I said, there were 400 hospitals that were eligible for this, and we were one of 35 that were chosen. And it really reflects the commitment from our perspective, again, from BJH and WashU, to really to quality improvement, which is so important as we continue to take care of these complicated patients.
Well, sure, Dr. Cates, that brings us to the end of our discussion. Time goes by so quickly when you're here, but thank you so much for being with us.
That's
great
my
talking
pleasure.
To you again. And if folks have questions, they can go to your website, I'm sure, and learn more and make contact with their cardiologist or whatever. But thank you, Dr.
Cates. Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up, happy birthday, Charles Lindbergh. It's next on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.